Welcome to Designed for More, brought to you by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Join Dr. Timothy Jennings, a renowned expert in psychiatry, neuroscience, and spiritual well-being, as he explores the connections between mind, body, spirit, and relationships.
Hello, welcome to Designed for More, sponsored by Common Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. I'm Dr. Tim Jennings, and I'm joined today by Danielle Rome, one of our therapists, and James Johnson, our chief chaplain. And today we are going to be discussing healing through movement, And I love this topic because our show is called Designed for More, and the four is, you know, mind, body, spirit, and relationships. And we're going to be talking about how movement, because we're integrated human being, and about how our physical activity has an impact on our brain and our overall well-being and mental health and spiritual health even. So where would you guys like to start on this? Healing through movement.
There are so many things that come to mind, and I'm really excited about this episode because I know so little about this.
Okay.
And so I'm just excited to learn. The first things that comes to mind is I really struggle with exercise personally. I struggle with being motivated, and also I struggle to know if I'm doing enough. And that's something I'm wondering about, is how much is the appropriate amount to be moving to where you're doing it enough to where it's helpful, but also is there a point where it's maybe too much?
That's an excellent question. I want to start with what you said. I struggled to, would you say, motivated to do it, is what you said?
Yeah, motivation. I like to walk, but I feel like there's more I should be doing.
So this, the motivation piece is huge. What the science shows is that the best outcomes from exercise is if you're doing an exercise that you enjoy. If let's say you've heard a lecture on the benefits of exercise, it slows aging, does so many good things for you, and you're one of those like willpower people, and you decide, okay, I'm going to do this, and you engage in some exercise that you really don't like. It's a gruel, it's a grind, and the whole time you're doing it, you're just like, I hate this, you're looking at your watch, I'll be glad this is over, but I'm going to do this because I have to, okay? That actually has does not have a great benefit for you, because mentally, when you do this out of something you don't like, you're activating your stress circuitry, your amygdala, which activates your stress hormone response and inflammatory cascades, and that whole stress response is actually working against what the physical exercise is trying to do for you, so you don't get the same good health outcomes if you're doing same exercise but with an attitude of disgruntledness and not liking it. So the data shows, find an exercise you enjoy or do something that helps you enjoy it. For instance, I tell people, if you can't find anything you enjoy, then get an audiobook and only listen to your audiobook while you're doing your exercise, whether it's a bike ride, whether it's going for a walk, and you look forward to your audiobook, or get some friends and you all go for a walk together or do something like that. Oftentimes, getting an exercise in through an activity, you know, whether it is basketball or walking on a golf course and golfing or tennis or pickleball or something where you are actually physically moving, but the exercise is actually a byproduct. I mean, you're not really focusing on the exercise, you're focusing on the activity. And the activity,
great,
yeah, is what gives you the exercise. Some people might do some type of dance. And dance is actually a great exercise. I'm talking your actual dance, not just, you know, what you do at a bar or something, okay, where you're actually doing dance moves. It's actually, it takes a lot of cognitive ability because you have to learn the steps and focus on the steps, follow the music. And if you're actually doing real dance, it takes a lot of good exercise. But the data shows walking is sufficient. 30 minutes of walking 5 days a week will slow aging, turn on neurotrophins, which are proteins that your brain make new connections, and reduce your dementia risks. So walking 5 days a week could be enough, but, you know, take walks in parks or places that are beautiful, or again, audiobooks or whatever you need to do, but have a positive mental attitude toward that.
That's great to know, because I do like walking, and I do it maybe not that often, but I do it with some frequency. But there's the, should I be running or should I be at the gym lifting weights, right? Because that's a lot of what I hear pushed as maybe more ideal.
Okay, this is another great point. The walking will be sufficient to keep your brain and cardiovascular healthy. Mm-hmm. The running, a lot of people like to run. Running through your lifetime actually can cause in some individuals, hip and joint problems, because you're wearing them down, even with running shoes and so forth. Women particularly, because women have wider hips, and because they have wider hips, then their femur. See, male femurs hit the pelvis more like this. Females will have a little bit like this because they have a little wider hips, and then that constant running can cause them more hip, and then their knees come down. They have a little bit of pressure, and constant pounding on that can cause women more problems than men.
Oh, interesting.
Okay, so and then the weights. Oh, weights. Muscle mass actually at rest has higher metabolism than fat. And so if you do weights, it maintains a higher baseline metabolism, which helps minimize, obesity as you age, and it's healthy for you. Additionally, any exercise, whether it's weights or the walking or running or biking or swimming or pickleball, any if you're exercising regularly, as you exercise, your muscles produce something called interleukin-10, which is a powerful anti-inflammatory cytokine, which suppresses inflammatory cytokines in your body, which reduces aches, pains, reduces your risk of depression, reduces your risk of dementia. It also turns on neurotrophins, which helps your brain stay healthy, endorphins and cephalins, which are mood elevators. And so studies show that just, I think it's 15 minutes of casual, or is it maybe 30 minutes? What was the number total? Let me see if I can remember. Per week, it was like an hour or two. I mean, I think it was 1 hour of casual exercise a week reduced your risk of depression by like 12%. Just casual exercise 1 hour a week. It's very, very small, but it has very positive benefit on you. So regular movement is healthy for the body and the brain.
Yeah. Wow. That's really cool.
Yeah. That's
fascinating.
You asked about too much. Yes. Too much exercise, extreme exercise, marathon running, Ironman stuff, actually worsens your health over time. You'll have more cardiovascular problems. You'll typically have more bone and joint problems. You'll have kidney problems, because what happens when you do extreme exercise is you will actually, tear up and break down the muscles, which then will repair. But the constant extreme exercise like that, and when you break down muscles, you have protein loss that hits the kidneys, and that actually causes more risk of kidney problems as you age as well. So it does not actually extend life. You don't have longer life or better health to do extreme exercise. So sedentary lifestyle do not have good health and do not age well. Extreme do not have good health and age well. So it's the moderate exercise in the middle, which is really great.
So what is it then, like, one of the things when I try to work out first thing in the morning, a few times a week, but I wake up and I'm, obviously there's the movement that can get your heart rate going, which I can understand wakes your brain up. But what is it about a good workout, a good exercise regimen that when you're done, you just feel better? Is it the accomplishment part of it, or is there actually something going on in the brain neurochemically that actually makes a person feel better about themselves in life after they exercise?
Well, I think it's both.
Okay.
Okay. Whenever we apply ourselves to achieve anything, I want to read this book, and you finish it, there's a sense of accomplishment. I want to, weed my garden, and you get all the weeds out, and you look at your garden. Ah, okay, you feel good. Any accomplishment will have a positive reward from that. But that's not all when it comes to exercise. So there is that piece to it. But physiologically, physical exercise does cause the brain to release endorphins and enkephalins, which are mood elevators, and dopamine, which is your reward chemical. All of those are released during physical exercise. And so you've probably heard of the runner's high. Okay. There is a physiological mood elevation that comes from good exercise, as well as the psychological positive reinforcement of achievement. So I think it's both.
Wow. That's awesome. Is there a difference between how beneficial it is to exercise outside versus inside?
Data actually shows, yes, that exercising in a natural environment outside, outdoors, is better than exercising in the gym. You get more endorphin release. You get lower cortisol levels. You have just a better physiological outcome. One study showed that you can get the same benefit exercising indoors if you're looking at murals of the outdoors.
Wow. Interesting. Okay.
So there's a psychological piece to that. And that's not fiction. We know that certain colors have a positive benefit on our mental health. Blues and greens. Mm-hmm. Blues are antidepressant. Blue light, you know about light therapy? It's the blue wavelength of light therapy that has the big physiological antidepressant effect. And greens, like grass and trees, greens have a calming, relaxing effect on us. So there's an actual impact of these colors that we see having a physiological and psychological impact on us. Isn't that interesting? You have art therapy. Yeah. Do you have anything to say about the colors?
Not necessarily on that front. I know colors can be quite personal. So yes, there are some studies that show specific objective benefits to different colors, but there's also a subjective component about people that have personal positive and negative association. So
sure. That would be the psychological piece.
Yeah, that's more the direction piece that I go. Yeah,
I gotcha.
That's awesome.
Well, I know a lot of years ago there was and still is today in the science of leisure and how we have fun and how we interact with physical and community activities. One of the things that was interesting where they were studying the difference between, saying that children can play, but at a certain point we lose that ability and they start calling it flow, where you become so involved in the activity that you lose track of time and it ends up being something that is, we use the word recreation, but you're actually recreating these things that are going on in your life. And I was reminded of my dad does a lot of physical activity, even though he's retired, in his wood shop. And so he's picking up boards, he's moving things around, he's doing this, but it's something very therapeutic for him. He wouldn't call it that, he just calls it fun. But what is it about doing these activities when we're being physical that helps us create this idea of refreshment, of renewal, of restoration in our lives? Is it just the physical activities, or is it actually something innate inside of ourselves that's actually creating that?
No, I think that's not the fit. What you described, you said something earlier, I want to come back to the flow.
Did I switch it into
the child? Okay. Yeah. But the what you described at the end, I think, is part of how we were created in the image of God with imagination and with a desire to create ourselves. We're beings who create art.
Yeah.
Okay. Or, woodshop working.
Which is art.
Which is art.
Yeah.
Or music, which is art. Mm-hmm. Or I write books. I wouldn't call that art, but there's art to writing, though. But yeah, you can say there's an art to writing. That's true. Creative expression. But any achievement. We are designed to take our energies into some type of productivity. I'm not saying for a paycheck, but then the work of our hands. When God created the earth every day, and it was good, and it was good, and it was, and there's a sense, and we have that when we apply ourselves and do something. There's a it was good. So that's, I hear you saying that.
Right. Yeah.
I think that's a fulfillment of our person, our identity, our individuality. I think it's a great psychological identity aspect of fulfilling our who we are created to be.
Mm-hmm.
The exercise piece, though, with children particularly, this is important, neurodevelopmental-wise, is important, and this is where I think sometimes in our education systems we are hurting children. Normal neural development, we have different brain circuits. Brain circuit that initiates motor movements. Okay, this is the brain circuit that gets damaged in Parkinson's disease. And they lose those neurons and, they become rigid, they stiff, they shake, and they have a hard time. And if it gets really bad, they can't move, they get frozen. They have masked face, they can't express themselves. Those same circuits that initiate motor movement initiate thought. Your motive to think, this motive to actually, so if we constrain kids where they don't develop these motor circuits, it can interfere with thinking circuits later.
Additionally, the cerebellum, which is in the back, is the part of the brain that coordinates our movement. So it's very smooth movement. So when you reach out to touch something and it's so smooth, that's your cerebellum. People with cerebellar problems would go like this and eventually find it because they don't have that smooth coordination. The central vermis, the central portion of the cerebellum actually organizes and coordinates thought. Okay. And so children who are allowed to play, and this is why kids want to be physical, because they're developing brain circuits through their physical activity. This is why they need lots of recess, lots of playtime, lots of games where they learn how to coordinate their body, kickball and baseball and stuff where they have to actually coordinate eye-hand coordination and all of this type of organization, ballet classes or dance classes or art classes where you have to find motor control. All of these things are developing neural circuits that govern the body, but those same neural circuits are involved in organization of our thought patterns and so forth. And so we put kids in seats and they sit there for 6 or 8 hours and they don't get the physical activity. Their bodies are designed by God to move, to be active at this age because it's neurodevelopmental. And then when they're fidgety and they're trying to be active, boom, ADHD, put them on drugs, sedate them. Okay. And this is very harmful. Okay. And I'm not suggesting there's not something called ADHD. There is. Okay. But those would be the outliers who, after an hour of hard exercise and recess, they still can't be still.
Yeah.
Okay. But they need, and many schools have reduced the playtime. There needs to be much more of that.
That's so sad.
And studies actually show schools that are in nature, instead of in a classroom, the outside classes, where the kids can actually be active during the education. The kids perform much better. They learn better. In fact, learning while doing activity is better than learning while just sitting.
Yep.
Which is interesting. You said that. I was reading an article just a few weeks ago that somebody sent me that was talking about scripture study and memorization. They were encouraging people to, you know, safely get up and move, and while they're reading their Bible, like, you know, maybe walk back and forth or listen to it. And they were saying that that was a much stronger way to enable the interaction with the text, because you weren't just sitting still and looking at a screen or a book for hours on end.
Correct.
That's interesting.
And do you notice how I and you and most people, when they're talking, are moving their hands,
right?
Okay. And when I do public speaking, much more fluid if I can move a little bit. You watch a lot of public speakers, they just walk a little bit back and forth. That's because there's a connection between your motor movements and your thought organization and pattern. Being frozen behind a podium can actually restrict some of your flexibility in thinking.
Yep.
And so there's a direct connection there. And I want people to understand that, the physical movement. So let your kids get lots of playtime. It's real important. We had lots of playtime growing up. In the schools we went to, we always had recesses and can go out. Do they still do that?
They're working to try to bring a lot of that back. One of the things when I was still in education that they realized that, in an effort to make up for what was missing in the home life, they were trying to add extra academic rigor. And so you had intensives, and they were taking away the more recreational activities of going to art class or going to music class, going to PE, and giving extra academic intensives. And after decades of studying, they're realizing that that's only further exacerbating the problem. And now they're bringing these things back. One of the studies that we were encouraged to put into place when I was still a school administrator was to give kids two different things, to give them structured physical education, where a teacher would teach them, this is how you play a game, this is how you do an exercise, this is how you do a sport, but then to give them recess, just free play, where they were supervised to keep them safe, but they were supposed to use that time to work interrelationally with their peers, to work through social struggles, to figure out how do we do this game together, not just individual activities.
So what it's cool. Really important what you said. Human development, children, normal development, need free, unsupervised playtime.
Mm-hmm.
They need to not just physically move, they need to decide for themselves the risk-reward ratio. And not have an adult restrain or restrict them from taking risk. This is how they learn to modulate in life their own fear and anxiety.
Wow.
And so if you look on a playground that's unsupervised, you will see a kid brings a skateboard. and it's new. And at first, everybody's just trying to learn how to stay on it and balance. After a period of time, and they're doing that well, they'll throw out a rope and say, pull me on this, and increase the force. And then after a period of time, they'll put a little ramp and let's do jumps, okay? What are they doing? They're increasing the risk of injury, okay? And then they will fall and get hurt at some point, whatever the game is, climbing on the monkey bars, swinging. When I was in first grade, first graders out there playing unsupervised, we had swings. And then the swings had wooden seats with chains. You remember these? Yeah, I don't know if they put in those soft whatever kind of vinyl little seats now. But we had wooden seats with chains, and the person swinging would stand on the swing, and you would swing standing. Oh, okay, cool. And then the other kids would run under them. So they would, as they go back, you run under before it comes back down. And all the kids would line up to run under the person swinging. And when I was in first grade, I got smacked right in the head. The swing hit me right in my forehead, knocked me down, cut my forehead, had to go get stitches, in my forehead. But that's unsupervised. My brother was doing that, and he jumped off and broke his arm. Okay. And what happens with that? And so kids get injured, and you need to let them, because what happens, you cry, you're hurt, and then you go home, you get scraped, you get bruised, you get cleaned up, and then you go, hey, but it was worth it. It was fun. Mm-hmm. I'm going to go out and do it again. Okay, I'm going to go out and do it again. And you decide, and because in our brain development, there are the circuits of creativity and adventure. The reward, the positive, discover something new. This is exciting. This is fun. And there's the circuit of fear, threat, and hide to be safe. These two circuits in balance. Unsupervised play allows children to, it's like a rheostat, to adjust their own level of risk reward, where they can then go away from mommy and daddy as they grow and mature and not feel frightened. And so historically, example, kids from my generation then go to college and they look at all of these new things they've never seen before, all these clubs, all these programs, all these different people from different cultures, all these different educational tracks that they've never seen. And the campus is like, emotionally, psychologically, an amusement park. It's like, oh, look at all this stuff, all this adventure, all these things to try, all these things to sample. It's like a 31 flavors, right? That's how it was when you let kids have unsupervised play, but what's happened over the last 20 years, maybe 25, is parents have become more restrictive. Society's become more restrictive. Playgrounds now have all the safe foam stuff. You won't see in a playground monkey bars where you can climb 20 feet and fall. You won't see. When I grew up, we had sliding boards that were about 20 feet and made with buffed steel, where you could fly down those things. Seriously, they were 20 feet like this, and you could go just zoom. Have you ever seen one like this?
Yeah.
Okay, they don't have those anymore. They're gone. And I
saw one. I didn't go on it.
Okay.
Wasn't allowed to.
No, this is it. But yeah, we had monkey bar and the merry-go-rounds that you could spin really fast and all this. It was great. Okay. But today they've taken all that away. And the parents don't let the kids go out unsupervised. They have to stay under some place where an adult can see them. And on the playground, the parents or the school sets up all the rules, and the kids don't get to set the rules and have the arguments and the fights and all the things that they would normally do that helps this brain develop. And so what happens then when they leave home and go to college and they see all this stuff, it's frightening. It's scary. It's not safe here. And so we need safe spaces at the college. And you're an aggressor because you disagreed with me. You're attacking me. And this is what we're seeing in college, because their brains have not been developed properly. And then we go down this trail of coddling. This is neurobiologic.
Interesting.
Okay. And so this is what we've done. We've actually injured and infantilized an entire generation through, I think, good intention. We want our kids to be safe. We don't want to get hurt. That's good. That's great. Who wants their kids to get hurt? Nobody.
Yeah.
Okay? Good intention but bad application.
Yeah, it's interesting because it, and I'm not saying this this excuses it, but there's an interesting pattern with generations where there's the, what is it called? The latchkey kids. Yeah. Where there is a feeling of neglect, a feeling of mom and dad weren't there to watch me. Mom and dad weren't there when I got hurt. So now I have to make sure my kids are watched. I have to make sure my kids don't get hurt. And I think I'm wondering if potentially it's a swing in the opposite direction from that kind of experience that a lot of the parents of this generation.
It could be. I think it's a combination of things. One is the helicopter parents and trying to take everything out. And also, you know, the people who want to control everybody else's life in society too. So they make it societal rules. You've got to do all this. You know, when I was a kid, and I'm not saying I disagree with this one, but I'll just show you the difference in mindset. When I was a kid, it was the norm that children, we had cars with bench seats instead of bucket seats. You know, bench seats, when a bench seat is. And the kids would be standing on the front bench seat between the parents, mm-hmm. the little kids. There's no seatbelts. When we were kids, we had no seatbelts. We would stand up, we would play in the back. Okay, so I'm not disagreeing with that one, but the point is, it wasn't through education and voluntary. It was regulation that you force people to. And this then extends out into many things in society. The playground for everyone has to be. It's not like, it's a sounding board. If it's too dangerous for your kid, they don't go on it. No, we take it away from all the families. And we don't let the families say, no, my kid can do that. Yeah. You see, this is the, and so society is pushed a certain protectiveness rather than, and in fact, in some states, you know, parents here recently have been cited and or arrested for allowing their children to go to the, you know, two blocks down to the store unsupervised.
Interesting. At what age, though, of children are you referring to?
8, 10.
Interesting. Okay. I'm not a parent, so I don't really have preference for that.
But historically, that was normal. Mm-hmm. Historically, that was normal. When I was growing up, 8, 10, 12, we rode our bikes. We went all over. We went miles away fishing and to stores with our allowance and bought candy and totally unsupervised.
But there's also worsened, like, social risk for kids, like child abductions.
That's not true. Like that. That's actually statistically, factually not true. There's less of that today than there was then.
That's interesting.
That's the data. Look the data up.
That's interesting. I'll look that up. I have a memory. I was trying to remember how
what you said is a belief that contributes to this, but yeah. It's not factually true.
That's interesting. I'll look that up because what I've heard is that that's factually true. So I'll look up and verify that. But okay. Like I have a memory. I don't remember. I think I was 6 or 7 and my parents were in the gas station with me, but there was a guy that like was trying to like usher me out of the gas station with him. And I was like I was almost abducted. Mm-hmm. It was wild. And I wonder if my parents weren't there, what would have happened, you know? So I also have thoughts like that kind of counteract that of, okay, well, there is a serious risk and maybe it's a small percentage, but where do we find this balance where there's helpful, creative freedoms that we can give kids while also not risking these more extreme consequences for the sake of choice?
Yeah, and I think that's the balance we have to figure out how to strike. That is, in my view, the parental choice. And place, circumstance make a difference. Growing up in rural, you know, farmland in the Midwest, different than growing up maybe in inner city,
right?
New York or Chicago.
Right. Yeah, exactly.
So setting rules for, since there's such a wide variety of culture and circumstance, this is where parents are the best to make these decisions, in my view, and not criminalize, freedom and parental decision on some of these things, but. You know, back to the exercise movement piece, the point here is this, what I'm making is about the neural developmental aspect, that there is actually important brain development elements that can be hindered by over restriction.
Mm.
That's my
point. Yeah,
so what do you do when you know, like you said, we've been doing this for 20, 25 years. We've got, at this point, we've got adults who have grown up in education systems where they weren't given a whole lot of free play. They didn't develop these mental capabilities that you've mentioned to be able to handle risk reward, the social situations. They've got increased anxiety. They've got fear of trying something new, you know, embarrassment, failure issues. And they find themselves in their adult years. And now they're suffering from, you know, overwhelming anxiety. They're suffering from social, you know, fears and hypervigilance as far as like, oh, I don't want to look like I'm doing something wrong. I don't want to be embarrassed. And then they're, you know, spending their free time coming home from work, watching, you know, passive television that we've talked about before that's not activating the things in their brain that cause them to critical think. What can we do physically through recreation and movement to help with this process? Are there any insights psychologically, psychiatrically that we can do to help recover from these failures that we missed in our developmental years?
That's such a good question. I actually have a thought with art therapy with that. So one of the benefits that can happen with art making is taking risk, is making art itself is a, you're not standing up. Well, you could be standing up, but it's a physical movement that you're making art, and it can be a contained risk. So for people who maybe in a life situation where they have kids, a job, you know, a lot of responsibilities where there isn't a lot of room for risk without high consequence, they can experience through art making and through using new materials and processes there that stir up anxiety for them, the capacity to experience that risk and be more comfortable or learn how to sit with the discomfort of risk in this contained space. So that's one thing that could be beneficial.
And when you're doing art, you're physically moving.
Yes. Yeah.
If you're drawing or painting, it's fine motor movement. Mm-hmm. There's art that can be more larger pottery or sculpting.
Yes.
Or woodworking.
Yeah.
Okay. So there's other types
or standing while painting on an easel. Yeah.
Right. Yeah. So there's a physical movement aspect in that too. But there's that expression aspect, opening oneself up, putting oneself out there in one's work for others to see.
Yes, that's true.
Okay.
Yeah.
So all those are important as well. What do you want to say about the connection between the body and the mind in people who've had trauma? And
yeah.
So I've heard people say, you know, that the body remembers or something like this in trauma. The body keeps a score. Well, it depends on what you mean by that. It really depends on what you mean by that. If they're talking about, well, your brain has laid in certain circuits, that's your body. So your brain is laid in certain circuits. Okay, I can buy that. Because if anything you do, music lessons, arts lessons, driving, learning how to swing a baseball bat and become proficient, golfing, anything you do, your brain is wiring it in.
Yeah.
So if they mean that you've wired into your brain certain patterns of responding in situations because of trauma, okay, I get that. And then, or are they actually meaning the body here is where it keeps score? Or because I don't buy into that. It's in the brain, but the body's responding to what's happening in the brain. But the brain is the place.
But we've seen physical ailments in people that are you and I have seen.
Yes.
That are connected to
trauma. But it's
not
coming from the body.
That's the power of belief examples we've talked about before.
It's coming from the brain,
right,
but it's showing
it's up expressing in
the body. In different parts of the body.
Yes, yes.
Yeah.
So the body isn't keeping the score. The body is displaying the score.
Okay, well, but your nervous system is throughout your whole body.
Right.
So that's
right. But where is it all? This is the point I want to make, because a lot of people then focus on body treatments. Okay, I got a physical symptom. I'll get massage. I'll get a surgery.
I see what you mean. But even that though, even a massage though is affecting your nervous system and affecting your brain, like a therapeutic massage.
Yes.
So that is still treating in some ways part of the.
So good point on the massage. If you get massage, you get endorphin release. Oh man, blocking all of a sudden on
dopamine.
No, it's
oxytocin.
Yes, thank you. Oxytocin.
Ah, so good.
Yes, yeah. Thank you. You get oxytocin release, which actually calms amygdala. It's very relaxing.
Safe physical touch.
Yep. Physical touch. So it's very healthy. It can be healthy, but it has a physical effect, particularly on the brain. Relaxes the brain, relaxes the amygdala, which reduces inflammatory cascades. So yes, again, though, the idea here then, and then physical exercise. I want to bring in the idea of exercise. Somebody who's highly stressed from a situation, they've just found out their spouse is cheating and has moved out, highly stressed. A child is very sick and in the ICU, highly stressed. You're highly stressed, okay. Can exercise be a benefit in high-stress situations?
I would guess so.
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely. Exercising, it can burn off energy. I can tell you my own personal life, I've had a few times in my life where something was going on in my life that was so upsetting to me, either through anxiety or anger, because somebody really, really wronged me and I was really angry. So much so, I couldn't think clear to process it. So what did I do? I went out for a run. At that age and that time, I ran. I was in the military and you did a lot of running. So I went out for a run. And the run, after several miles of running, was burning off energy, also endorphins and Keflins. Eventually, it helps. Remember the thinking circuits when you exercise? And eventually, the intense emotional energy didn't resolve the problem. It just neurobiologically calmed me enough and engaged prefrontal cortex enough that during the run I can start thinking and processing. And I was also talking to the Lord, okay? Mm-hmm. But exercise can be very beneficial in those intense moments to really kind of calm it down enough so that you can start working through the issue. Have you ever found that to be true?
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah, absolutely. For me, walking, good, but also doing chores, the physical movement of, you know, doing laundry or doing different stuff around the house can help me have focused, goal-directed activity, which then can help me calm down and then afterwards revisit whatever it is that's upsetting me. And often I'll have new realizations after. So that's something that...
That's excellent too. And we found, for instance, sometimes patients who get into a really bad depression, and they are just like listless, and you try to talk to them and it's like there's not much going on.
Yeah.
You give them basic tasks to do. Get up and help set the table and do this task or the basic work. Go and clean the bathrooms, whatever. Not as punishment, just to make them do. And that activity can oftentimes get them thinking again where they can start talking. So there's a therapeutic aspect to that as well. And this is why here at Honeylike, in our program, you know, we have a very holistic program integrating all four of those domains. We have a campus where everybody gets walking every day as they go to the various, in nature. Walking is beautiful nature. But we also have a wellness program with a gym where we have a, you know, exercise trainer that will help people. And we have the stretching and the other scheduled programs where they do various types of exercise and stretching. And then they can go and actually do more over at the gym and stuff because we understand the physical, you know, activity is so good for the brain healing and brain development.
That's awesome. Yeah, absolutely. And I've seen that in the patients I've worked with too, is just they'll say, wow, I love walking. I had no idea. And I never have walked this much in my life. But, or they'll first get here and they'll say, my legs are tired, and then give them a week and they're proud of themselves because they're able to move so much more than they're used to. It's really cool to see something that seems pretty minor have such a significant impact in treatment.
Yeah, no, there's no question about it. What would you say, I'm going to put that to the chaplain, and I don't want to put you on the spot, but biblical verses, examples of, you know, exercise?
You know, there's some really interesting ones to me that when Jesus was with his disciples, they traveled on foot, you know. But one of the things that we see throughout their journey is the community building that they do. I mean, that's when they're walking and talking. Jesus often taught using life examples that they saw as they were out and about. So, you know, we see the teaching learning process going on there that Jesus as the master teacher utilized. We see the idea of worship being physical. Now, you know, we don't have a temple where we go offer sacrifices anymore, but the physical activity of worship, stimulating the brain to get them to think, not, you know, I know we've talked about before, like in the temple when they would go and offer the sacrifice, but the goal
was Romans 12, right. Come on, connect it.
Yeah, absolutely. It's not offering the sacrifice that pays a price back. It's the interaction with God in the sacred space and understanding the need to change our heart and mind through the physical activity of what we're doing.
But Romans 12, 1, the sacrifice, we're to offer our
Bodies
and the living sacrifice. I was just connecting what you're saying.
Because, you know, we have the idea of our body being the temple of the Holy Spirit, mm-hmm. the same Spirit that raised Christ Jesus from the dead lives in us. So we get to take care as stewards of what God's given us. We actually worship Him by taking care of our bodies and our minds, not just memorizing scripture and, you know, going through, you know, the motions. We actually become a better vessel to bring His kingdom and to love other people well.
Well, and Paul wrote, may your whole spirit and soul and body be kept blameless. And so, you know, the Bible teaches that the righteous will take care of their body.
Mm-hmm. Love the Lord your God with all your heart, mind, soul, and strength.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so we can think of the strength of our will, but also of the strength of our body. Am I healthy enough to actually go and you know, some of the greatest ministry experiences I've ever been part of or ever received are when people did physical things, you know, either with me or for me, whether that was, you know, a service project, whether that was, you know, helping to, you know, give things to people or whatever, like, you know, food ministries. But, you know, definitely there's an interaction to it. And I have, I've been interested in, there's a debate in the church world right now as to atmosphere creation, you know, that do I come in and sit down in my chair and listen to a sermon and be very solemn, or when you have more of the interactional experiential worship, some people are saying, oh, you're fabricating an experience with the lights and the sounds and the, you know, more of the rock band kind of feel. But is there something to our worship when we get physically involved, whether that's kneeling in prayer, whether that's raising our hands in worship, the old school way of praying, you know, for a lot of cultures was to bow down to the ground, that it's a heartbeat of an attitude of submission. Not that we necessarily are making God pleased with us by earning His love, but just the interaction of the physical with the mental and the spiritual can make those connections. So I'm sure there's extremes on both ends. But when we talk about our love for God, I absolutely agree that when we have healthy bodies, you know, it overflows into our spirit for sure.
That's awesome.
I'm thinking about what you're saying. But the Bible teaches the principle of health.
Mm-hmm.
I'm just wondering if there's any verses that encourage us to, you know, run or exercise.
Well, in 1 Timothy, where he says, you know, that physical training is good, but training for godliness is better because it produces eternal, you know. And so he's not saying that you have to have one or the other, that when we put both together, I mean, some of the greatest opportunities of ministry in the scriptures are when people are using their bodies in action to help people, whether that's, you know, traveling to go visit people. You know, Paul had to go place to place as opposed to, you know, letter writing when he had to, but he longed to be with them physically. So there's definitely a physical element to.
Go ahead.
Here's a thought. A lot of the prophets, God had to do physical symbolic mm-hmm. actions to represent what God is wanting to communicate to the people. So there's definitely a value described there of doing physical things to symbolize something that's beyond the physical. So we can look at exercise as a value in that way too.
I like it.
Yeah.
So is there, in fact, there is, let's talk about anything you guys want to say about those who maybe become exercise addicts. They actually, exercise almost becomes, you know, their addiction, really.
Mm.
They exercise compulsively and or exercise to promote their body.
Right. That was me for years, that I had to work out 2 hours a day, an hour of cardio, an hour of weightlifting. I got so into weighing out my macronutrients and measuring everything out that it got in the way of my social connections, because if you invited me out to lunch, I would bring my lunch. So I knew exactly what I was eating.
Wow.
And that definitely, you know, it's kind of weird to show somebody invites you over to their home for dinner and you bring your dinner with you. That's weird. And it got to the point where one of my good buddies went on a run with me, and he stopped in the middle of the run and he said, James, I'm worried about you, because you are taking this to an extreme. And it was definitely a compulsion more than a benefit. I could not sleep at night if I did not do all of the exercise. If my weight changed too much one way or the other, you know, it definitely increased my and my restlessness and my discomfort, my mental image for myself was definitely off. So it definitely can be, I've experienced it.
So what was the, okay. I assume that you are no longer doing this.
Yes.
Okay. Would you be able to share with us as you reflect back on that, what was the driver that got you into that? And then how did you get out of it?
Well, it started from a place of fear because before I joined the military, I grew up in a very sedentary lifestyle. Food was our family's love language. So I have a connection to food very emotionally. And so if I was feeling bad or about something or I wanted to feel good, I would go and eat my feelings, so to speak. And so I had a doctor's appointment in my early 20s where he said, James, if you keep living like this, you probably won't get past your 60s. And that kind of scared me. And as I started seeing the progress, that I started feeling better, I started losing weight. And that metric of the weight loss, the body change.
And you felt better.
I did. I felt better. Became the measurement rather than, and the progress in the beginning was rewarding so much so that it became the purpose.
And wait, let me ask this. If this happened as well, you started being proud of yourself.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
And so it became a, I'm good.
Mm-hmm.
I like me. Look, I'm strong.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sexy.
Oh yeah, my wife messed with me one time and she said, you haven't found a mirror you don't like. Yeah, and that was because every time I saw one, I had to check myself out.
Right, and I just want to put this out there because this is an important dynamic. When we apply ourselves in godly ways to do healthy things, the devil can try to trap us into pride.
Mm.
Into doing it for self to make self feel good. And then it can go over to the point of a compulsion.
Yes.
To make us, we're afraid not to. It's not out of love. It's not out of wisdom. It's not out of a desire to maintain the spirit temple to be useful for God. It's not altruistic. It's self-validating. And so that's what I heard you describe. But then you got out of it. What got you out of it?
I kind of realized that it had become an idol. That I was worshiping the act rather than saying, and very, very pharisaical, that you know, the same reason Jesus criticized the religious leaders, he wasn't criticizing what they were doing. He was criticizing the heart behind why they were doing it. So it wasn't, I realized that activity and health and good nutrition, those are all wonderful things when I'm using it as a worship to God rather than a worship to myself.
Yeah. So it was a spiritual journey.
Mm-hmm.
That's what people to realize that you can do good things with really unhealthy motives. And then that can then take the behavior maybe to an extreme that instead of now being a blessing can start hurting you.
Mm-hmm.
Yep.
Hurting your relationships, as you describe.
Oh, yeah.
But extreme exercise, as we talked about, can be harmful. But people still keep doing it. We see this, of course, this type of exercise also with eating issues and anorexics. Mm-hmm. They will do extreme exercise and restrict food because of similar dynamics to what you described, but even more extreme. It's all about self-protection and fear and inadequacies, and they're trying to be in control and make themselves feel better, and they will feel guilt. And it's the same underlying dynamic that I think you were describing. And sometimes people get into the extreme exercise and do that.
Yeah.
It reminds me of the passage when you're just trying to talk about the idea of balance in Ecclesiastes, where Solomon says there's a time for everything. You know, and that there is a time to be active. There's a time to, you know, recognize that there's other things in life too. And that there's something that definitely got in the way of my relationships. It got in the way of my relationship with God even, because like it was something I was compulsory to have to do.
So what you described there brings me back to the text from Paul in 1 Thessalonians 5:23. May your whole spirit, soul, and body be sanctified.
Mm-hmm.
There's a balance. We are embodied beings. In other words, we have a body, we have a soul, we have a spirit embodied together, all three together to be functional. And all three need to be healthy. The health, if you undermine the health of any aspect, for instance, the body, if your body's unhealthy, it actually interferes with your thinking and your motivational energy. So spirit, for people, let's not think mystical. Spirit in the Bible really just means motivational energy. What motivates you? Are you motivated with a spirit of fear? God did not give us a spirit of fear, but of power and of love and sound mind. You're motivated with a spirit animating energy of love or fear. It's really a love and fear issue. Fear also causes the drive to survive me first. Love causes altruism and trust. So the spirit is motivated. So you have a sick spirit, fear, insecurity, guilt, shame. If your spirit is sick, okay? And that will lead to then behaviors and thinking and activities in the body and the soul that are not healthy. If your soul, which the Greek is psyche, individuality, your thinking patterns, you might think like computer software, is sick with, I'm no good, I mess up, God hates me, nobody likes me, I'm ruined, I'm dirty, I'm gross. Okay, if you have a belief system about yourself that's unhealthy, that's going to activate fear circuitry. It's going to cause inflammation in your body. You may respond by overeating in comfort or food restriction and not eating, etc. And then if you have an issue where maybe you just have some insecurities because and you got some truth that frightened you and you respond with bodily responses to the point that you start harming yourself. Okay, then that can reinforce the fear because then you get an injury. And I've seen people who we've seen people who were holding it together with bodily interventions, exercise, and then you got an injury and they couldn't exercise. And their whole world collapsed into depression. They're overwhelmed. They don't know how to function. And so true health is a healthy body that we maintain for the glory of God. With a healthy mind that loves truth and is always seeking to update our understandings of ourselves and the world around us and God and everything with ever-advancing truth, because we're finite, but we love truth, with a heart that's motivated to love God and others. Okay, and we're open, and that's spiritual maturity, and we're open to have conversations that disagree, and we don't get threatened by that.
Yeah, absolutely.
Does that make sense to you?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah.
Anything else you guys want to share on the before we wind this episode up?
Well, so what are some simple steps that somebody who says, okay, I've been sedentary, I've been a byproduct of the culture, I've just sat in front of a screen for years and years, but I want to do this, but I don't know where to begin. What are some healthy first steps that we can take to begin using our physical activity to help improve our life and experience healing?
I like what you said about finding a physical activity that you like, and I'm wondering if people can try to adopt a perspective of curiosity and creativity, and let's experiment with a bunch of different things and little simple games like pickleball is easier than tennis, right? And like things that might be simple that you can get some friends involved in and just try.
I love that.
Yeah.
But I want to give some counsel of wisdom. Be realistic about where you're starting from. Mm-hmm. If you're starting from a position of significant physiological unwellness, get a physical exam by your doctor.
Yeah.
Number one, to make sure you're not in danger of where you're starting from going out and actually causing a problem. Number two, even if you love, also I would love to play any game or sport, basketball, whatever. Don't start with something that has high risk of injury for you. You want to, if you're sedentary and you don't have the motor strength or coordination, you're overweight, go out and start with something that has low risk of injury as your first. For instance, you might need to simply start with walking.
Yeah.
You might need to start with walking. You might start in a gym with some light weights and some short exercises, and you slowly increase. And your goal might be to get where you're going to be on that court playing, but you may not be able to start there. If you have ankle problems, you might not want to start with pickleball or tennis because of the side-to-side ankle issues, and you might roll your ankle, and then your back can't even walk now. So in wisdom, be honest with where you're starting from and start with something that is low risk of injury and then move up. So some people may start and they may only be able to do a five-minute walk.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, do a five-minute walk. 5 days a week. The next week, you should be able to go to 10 minutes. Do 10 minutes 5 days a week.
Yeah.
And then you may be, and next week, you should go to 15. You should get up to 30 minutes, minimum 30 minutes, 5 days a week on a walk. And then you may walk real slow. And then you actually, as you get better, after you get to 30 minutes, you also increase some of the pace of your walk. And that may be what you have to start with. And then when you get that kind of endurance, that cardiovascular, then you can maybe go hiking and walk on trails and things that actually require more coordination than just a flat and the ups and downs in the hills, and take a friend with you or listen to a book. But yes, find an exercise you like, but also start with low risk and then slowly ease into it. Because your muscles, your tendons, your bones, as you exercise, they will strengthen. Your bone density will improve. If you go out with a high impact, you can get something called shin splints. Shin splints are microfractures in the bone and also tears of the tendons and fascia, and it's very painful.
It hurts.
Okay, and so you don't want to do that if you have. So you work into it easy, where your density of your bone increases, your the strength of your muscles and tendons and ligaments increase as you exercise. Mm-hmm. And so that's my wisdom on that. So,
and here's another follow up thought with that, and this is. We mentioned earlier with trauma, and there can be almost a dissociation between your mind and body. You can lose awareness of different physical sensations and stuff like that. And if you're have a background where that's something you relate to and you're trying to go into exercise, it could be valuable to start with stretching and stuff that's you're just in your home. It's okay. Like, just stand up and do some stretching. And that brings some awareness into different physical sensations and stuff like that. And then when you start the walking, you can be aware if, okay, my ankle's starting to hurt or my knee is starting to hurt, stuff like that, if you've been also adding that other physical awareness piece.
Thanks for joining us today. And if you'd like a resource, a book that would actually have a lot of information with references about exercise, also diet and many other things, my book, The Aging Brain, Proven Steps to Prevent Dementia and Sharpen Your Mind, has a lot of information about exercise and resources that actually will give you those references on the outcomes and the benefits of exercise. If you have questions, send those into questions@designformore.net. questions@designformore.net, and we'll see you next time.
Thank you for joining us on Designed for More, brought to you by Come and Reason Ministries and Honey Lake Clinic. Also, don't forget to check out our other podcasts for more inspiring content.